in San Antonio. A lot of it was focused on me. And I found out today that our school happened to be the first one in our district to get the best MERV 13 filters installed, which they've been promising for a long time. I wonder if those things are connected. And so it's like these tiny victories that we are adding up and adding up, trying to keep people safe. And that's the only thing, unfortunately, that's on our minds.
I don't want to take any more time. And it pretty much says that we have to keep organizing and reorganizing and keep going at it to keep people safe. That's been our objective the whole time. We are going to err on the side of safety. We're going to do everything to keep us safe, even when the district isn't. So that's our priority. Number two is building power within that. And we're going to build power. We're going to build a voice and create a voice that cannot be denied. Because this is not just about COVID. It's about the labor movement and about power of workers in the state of Texas. And it's just the next vehicle. It's the next issue. We'll have an issue after COVID. And so we just keep rolling with the issues to build powerful workers. And that's what it's about.
Well, thank you so much, Ken and Luke. This was really a wonderful conversation with you both. Thanks for joining us on KBOO. Thanks to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes, and you've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. I'm Doug McVeigh. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. We seek to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safe, healthy, and just society. The 2020 general election was historic on many levels. In terms of the criminal justice system, one of the most important measures on that ballot, possibly one of the most important measures in decades, was Oregon's ballot measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act. On this edition of Prison Pipeline, we talk with one of M110's chief petitioners, Haven Wheelock. Haven has a Master's of Public Health from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and is the Syringe Services Coordinator for Outside In, a Portland area nonprofit. She's worked in harm reduction and direct service provision in Portland for many years. She took time recently to talk with me about M110, the vote, and next steps for implementation of the measure. Now, congratulations on the overwhelming victory on Tuesday. Measure 110 received more than 58% of the vote. Last time I checked, it was at 58.5% to be precise. I mean, just wow. Congratulations. You must be thrilled.
My heart is exploding with like love and gratitude for the Oregon voters and everyone who worked on the campaign. This is a really big move for our state, and I'm really proud of us as a state for being brave and showing up and really trying to create something new and exciting. So yeah, I'm very grateful.
So now I know that in essence, this measure decriminalizes the simple possession of several drugs, and it also makes it easier for people to access treatment if they want treatment. But you're a chief petitioner. Tell us what this thing will do now that it's been approved.
It is so exciting. So there's a bunch of things that I'm really grateful for and excited about with this measure. But I think the decriminalization piece of this measure is one of the most important parts of this measure. So basically it'll move simple possession, just low level possession from what is currently either a misdemeanor or felony, depending on your history, to a violation, so like a ticket. It'll be a $100 fine that you can pay and be done with, or that you can have waived if you have a health assessment to really look at, like, if you have a substance use disorder or if there are other like supports that you need around your substance use. So for me, we know that in Oregon, we are arresting Black, Brown, and Indigenous people at higher rates than white folks for crimes like drug possession. And this measure will effectively eliminate the racial bias in our arrests. It will mean that people will have access to supports that they need if they are struggling with their substance use, as it will create probably the largest investment Oregon has ever seen in supports for folks who use substances. So it's going to take marijuana tax revenue exceeding what was allotted when recreational marijuana was initially voted for by the voters. Anything over that threshold will be invested into treatment and recovery supports for folks. Additionally, it will take the money that is not being spent to arrest, jail, prosecute, probation from the criminal justice system. It'll take any savings by getting rid of these arrests and also invest that into recovery supports, harm reduction services, treatment supports for folks who have substance use disorders.
Okay, now, first, could you unpack a bit about the when you talk about treatment and recovery supports? People think of treatment, it, you go in, talk to a counselor, maybe sit in a group and tell war stories, and then go back out on the streets, or maybe you go in for methadone. That's treatment. Support services, what's the support services? What's this?
So what we know is that addiction is a chronic relapsing condition, right? Most formal treatment, like people are thinking about treatment, you're talking like weeks to months. But what we know is actually if we support folks up to 5-6 years after treatment, they are less likely to resume use. So, right, like if you go in, spend, you know, 3 weeks doing a treatment and then are discharged back to the streets, your chances of sustaining that sobriety is really low. Right. So this funding will allow for things like supportive housing for folks who are needing that level of support. It will allow for follow up, for employment services, for pretty much it's a really wide range of services that people can have. It will also be able to fund harm reduction services, which for me is really important because while I think of harm reduction on a couple of things, one, it's like, before people are ready to engage in treatment, we provide supports and services to folks to help get them there. But it's also like a safety net for folks who are resuming use, right? If this is a disease that relapse is really common, it's not more common than relapse to high blood pressure or relapse to like high blood sugar if you're being treated for diabetes, but it's about the same. And so we expect that some folks will resume use. And we want to make sure if that is the case, that they also have services to help keep them alive and to get the supports they need to get them back on the path they want to be on. And so I'm just really excited that we're really going to be able to invest in more than just what Medicaid will cover, right? Medicaid doesn't cover these other supportive services. And so this will allow for more folks to have access to all of it, because people are getting support across the continuum of care.
That's, wow, okay. So when you, because, I mean, it's fascinating to me because one of the things about the drug war in general has been that some people view drug use simply as a moral failing. And if you just threaten them enough and get them to straighten up and fly right, then that's all that's needed. And more sensible people look at things like, you know, housing security and food security and just emotional stability, other kinds of issues that may be going on, physical ailments that people may be experiencing, and realize that, yeah, there's a lot more to it than just, is this person bad?
So with this, you can actually deal with some of those real issues, the housing and the food and the rest of it, that the real drivers of substance use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the goal, right? Like, it's pretty well accepted at this point, right? That substance use disorder is a health condition, a behavioral health condition for the most part. I mean, there's a whole bunch of nuance that I could go into. But for, like, in general, right? And so this idea that punishing people works is literally just not true, right? You can look at what we've done for the last 100 years, right? And really, like, the escalation for the last 50 years and see that, like, jailing folks ain't working. If it was, we wouldn't be in this mess, right? Like, if punishing people and increasing penalties kept people from using drugs, we wouldn't be in an addiction crisis today, because it would have worked when it started in the 80s and the 90s, right? And so this is a really new way of approaching this that, it's new to the US. It's a new way to the US to approach this. But when we look at research internationally, right, we have 20 years of data coming out of Portugal saying that when you stop punishing people, health outcomes improve, overdose death rates improve, HIV infections improve, crime is diminished. Like, it's out there. We know that this works in other places. And beyond that, it's just the right thing to do. Why are we punishing people for being sick? Why? Like, it's cruel. Why are we putting people in cages for symptoms of a disease that we have evidence-based practices to help support them that work when we know jail doesn't?
We'll hear more from my conversation with Haven Wheelock about Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, in a moment. You're listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Steve Rolls is a senior policy analyst at Transform Drug Policy Foundation, an NGO based in the UK. They've just released a new publication called How to Regulate Stimulants, A Practical Guide. Here's Steve.
Yeah, firstly, just a few overarching aims and principles. I mean, it's always weird to have to even say this, but the sort of aims of the war on drugs and the sort of prohibitionist paradigm are so sort of weird and perverse. You know, the idea that you will create a drug-free world, that we can use punishment to deter use and stop people using, and then we can use sort of enforcement, often militarized enforcement, to stop, to eradicate drug markets and to prevent drug supply. And the measures that of success are all about seizures and arrests and so on. But I think it's worth reminding ourselves what we're actually trying to achieve with our drug policy here. And I'm not going to go through this with any detail, and a lot of these things have already been touched on by our brilliant speakers you've heard from already, but it's about things like human rights, public health, particularly protection of young and vulnerable populations. It's about social justice, ensuring equity, making sure populations who've been impacted by the war on drugs, whether it's people who use drugs or people who grow drugs or people who've been impacted by drug war-related violence, make sure that they are centered as we develop alternatives to the war on drugs, make sure that their interests are not marginalized. It's about issues of security and development, and we've heard from, you know, Thailand and Mexico and Colombia, and seen just how grim the outcomes of the war on drugs can be. Obviously, it's about crime reduction. Those are things we're trying to achieve. Those are things we're clearly not achieving with the war on drugs. And how do we do that? In terms of our overarching principles that have guided our work, we have a central idea of trying to minimize commercial profit incentives in any new regulated market. We've tried to learn from the failings and in some cases successes of alcohol and tobacco regulation, particularly the fact that we need to make sure that policy is not being driven by commercial profit motives and is driven by the need to deliver what I've just said, human rights, public health and so on. And you'll see that reflected in our proposals. Policy needs to be science and evidence based. Again, it's weird to have to say that, you know. But the war on drugs, it's not. It's anti-science. It's evidence averse. It's been driven by politics and ideology and a whole series of motives that have got nothing to do with public health at all, and by lies. And you know, when you have policies driven by those things, inevitably it's going to be a disaster, as the war on drugs has. So we're all about the science and evidence. Regulation, just the concept of regulation as a way of managing and minimizing risks. Different drugs, different behaviors are associated with different risks. So you use different regulatory tools in different ways. There's a menu of options, and there'll be it's not a one size fits all approach. And also, it needs to be, it's not written in stone. Unlike the war on drugs, which in many ways is written in stone, it's very sort of ideological and built around these very sharp moral binaries. We see evidence as evolving on the basis of evidence, and it needs to be flexible and able to change and respond to evidence of what's working and what's not. So, just moving quickly on, in terms of the production of drugs, when we're talking about pharmaceutical preparations of amphetamines or MDMA or cocaine. It's useful to remind ourselves that these things already exist. These all already have legal production for medical uses. There is a legal cocaine market. People don't know a great deal about it. It does have some limited medical uses. There's a huge legal amphetamine market. There are literally billions of amphetamine pills are produced legally for medical uses every year already. And there is a very small, but nonetheless does exist legal MDMA market for therapeutic use of MDMA. So we know how to produce these things to established pharmaceutical production standards. And essentially, in terms of the actual mechanics of production, all it means is expanding that production in a very similar way. The products that we'll be selling are pharmaceutical products, and they would be produced as pharmaceutical products would be, in fact, as pharmaceutical products of the same drugs already are. As we've heard from a number of the speakers, particularly in the Colombian example, there are some plant-based precursors for drugs, particularly the coca leaf. And we need to remember that on the production side of the precursors, we need to center sustainable development thinking. And we've heard from the from IDPC about their approaches to cannabis, and we've heard about the Colombian bill and looking after traditional indigenous coca producers. I'm not going to be able to talk about that because I just don't have the time, but there's a detailed chapter discussing that with lots of links to other work. But again, we need to, again, this is part of the social justice piece, that we need to center people who have been negatively impacted by the war on drugs, and make sure those interests aren't marginalized as we develop alternatives. The products themselves, these are some mock-ups we've done of the product packaging for potentially legally regulated cocaine, dexamphetamine and MDMA. As you'll see, there's unbranded pharmaceutical style packaging. They would be child and tamper resistant. They'd have very clear product content labeling and dosage information. There'd be very prominent risk and harm reduction information. That's the sort of big yellow boxes there you can see. And there'd be directions to further information, things like websites or QR codes, so you could find out more if you wanted to. And we would also have information on inserts. And if you think these look a lot like pharmaceutical drugs, that's obviously, that's very deliberate. They're unbranded, there's no kind of marketing. We want to make this as functional as possible to meet demand, but without actually promoting demand. So moving on, the vendors. We've proposed a state monopoly retail model where the government actually owns the retail, owns and manages the retail outlets. The reason for this is that basically we don't trust commercial interests. If you see what's happened with alcohol and tobacco, as I've already alluded to, there's clearly a tension between the interests of public health and the interests of profit-seeking corporations selling potentially risky drugs. We feel that a state monopoly retail model can potentially take those dangerous commercial incentives out of the equation to a significant extent. And alongside that, we'd obviously also have a total advertising and marketing ban similar to that we've seen with tobacco in many countries in recent years. we like the idea of a pharmacy style retailer where you have trained individuals, a bit like pharmacists, who would act as a gatekeeper to access of the market. They would enforce a regulatory framework, things like age controls or intoxication of purchases or any rationing controls, but they would also be specifically trained to give advice and required to give advice on risks, on harm reduction, and refer people to other information services or medical health services as appropriate. So, you know, pharmacies already can demonstrate a way of controlling access in a safe and effective way to a whole series of potentially risky drug products. So we're borrowing that idea and suggesting that you would have dedicated non-medical drug retail outlets run along the lines of a pharmacist model. There would also obviously be controls on location where the outlets could be based. Things like external signage and hours of opening, and some of this could be determined locally as opposed to under national legislation. It was really good to hear from Lorenzo about what's made it into the Columbia bill, because we do actually propose a three-tiered approach. A lot of drug policy at an international and domestic level at the moment is based on really outdated or in a completely inappropriate risk assessments. It's based on the pharmacology of the drug itself. In the case of cocaine, you have coca leaf cocaine and crack cocaine are all prohibited under the same schedules, both in international and many domestic laws. And whilst they are pharmacologically the same product, obviously they're vastly different in terms of their risks and behaviors associated with them. So we've talked about a three-tiered approach. What I've just described, the pharmacy model in state retailing, this would be for the pharmaceutical preparations, powder cocaine, MDMA pills, or dexamphetamine sulfate pills. And as Lorenzo alluded to in the Columbia bill for coca regulation, coca products, coca leaf, coca tea, and so on, would be more commercially available, something more like energy drinks, coffee, chocolate, and so on, whereas the very risky preparations, smoked preparations like crack or methamphetamine, we don't anticipate a retail model. We struggle to think how a retail model could really operate for those. So we've actually proposed, as Lorenzo touched upon, you wouldn't criminalize people who use those drugs, but you would manage their use within a harm reduction framework. So you would have supervised consumption spaces for use. You would have service provision, treatment, and harm reduction, including options for substitute prescribing. And you would have appropriate levels of provision of support and wraparound care services, things like health services, mental health services, housing and employment support, that kind of thing. So again, it's not a one size fits all approach. Different regulation models for different levels of risk and different drug products. So conscious of time, I'm going to stop. There's loads and loads of other stuff I'd love to talk about, love to tell you about. And I think we're gonna do a set of other webinars to explain some of those things. Drugs in the nighttime economy, drugs in development, drugs and harm reduction. So please do, download the book. It's free. We really want to hear what you think. You can buy print copies, but yes, we're trying to start a conversation. So take a look, read it, tell us what you think. If you rate it, share it with people, and help us promote this important, overlooked, and historically marginalized part of the drug policy and regulation debate. Thanks very much.
That was Steve Rolls, Senior Policy Analyst at the Transform Drug Policy Foundation, discussing their new publication, How to Regulate Stimulants, A Practical Guide. This is Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, back to my conversation with Haven Wheelock about Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which was approved overwhelmingly by voters in the 2020 general election. You got the law in place. Now, how are you going to make sure they follow it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of work to be done, right? So the measure calls for creating an accountability council that is made up of people with lived experience, people who have been most impacted by the war on drugs, social service providers that provide this work. It's really medical providers, addiction docs, those kind of folks, which is very different than any other model we've had. All of our other, all of Oregon's other kind of addiction focused work groups are heavy with law enforcement and the criminal justice system. So this is like a new kind of counsel. And so really the big first step in my mind is getting that counsel up and running, right? By February 1st, we have to have a hotline up and running so that folks who are ticketed for a possession can get that waived. So we got to create that mechanism of how do you go from getting a ticket to having it waived if you want to, up and running. And that all has to happen before February 1st. So our timeline is tight. However, we have an amazing team of humans who've been thinking about this with our fingers crossed that we're not like wasting time, energy, and right? Like we've been talking about it for a minute, knowing that our timeline's short. We did that on purpose because this is life-saving work that needs to happen because people are dying and having their lives destroyed today. We don't want to put this off until, you know, 2023. We want it to happen now. And so, yeah, we've got our work cut out for us. I'm not going to question that. And, you know, and I think we need to, like, our table needs to expand. And we're working on the best ways to bring as many voices in on this as possible. And for me, like, as someone who is a community organizer who loves all the humans, I really am looking forward to this part and to, like, really getting a rich array of ideas and thoughts, because I have a ton of ideas and so do a lot of other people. And the more threads in the fabric, the stronger, the more resilient, the better the system of care can be. And so I'm very excited about that part.
Haven, any closing thoughts for the listeners, and how can people find out more about Measure 110, but also how can people find out about the organization you work with outside in? Because you do some great work.
Thank you, Doug. And that's really sweet. I mean, God, I love the work that I do. So Outside In, to learn more about Outside In, it's outsidein.org. You can reach out there. It's an amazing organization doing amazing work. Like the program I run is just one small part of our agency as a whole, as an FQHC. And we've been in the community a long time. And so I'm really honored to do this work for Outside In. In terms of the measure, Measure 110, our website's still up. If you want to learn more about the measure, if you want to get involved, you can still reach out through that website. If you're interested in implementation, hit me up at havenw@outsidein.org and we'll figure it out if you want to join us on that team. Doug, thank you for having me on today. It's always a pleasure when I get to talk to you. I think our first conversation was what, 6 years ago on safe consumption spaces or something like that.
I was a last minute substitute host and you were kind enough to agree to be a guest. And it was one of my first times doing a live talk show too. So I think I was sitting there with like a half a ream of papers trying to keep myself together. Oh my God. And you were terrific as you always have been. And you got the passion for the work that you're doing. I mean, it's not just a job.
No, this is my heart and soul, man. I love people who use drugs more than pretty much any other group of people on the planet. So it's pretty exciting, and I'm very lucky that I get to do this work.
That was my conversation with Haven Wheelock about Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Addiction Treatment and Recovery Act, which was approved overwhelmingly by Oregon voters in the 2020 general election. Haven was one of the chief petitioners for Measure 110. She's a longtime harm reduction activist and is the Syringe Services Coordinator for Outside In, a Portland-area nonprofit. And for now, that's it. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you have been listening to Prison Pipeline. Find this and other installments of Prison Pipeline on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. It's at facebook.com/prisonpipeline. Many thanks to our engineer. and a heartfelt thanks to you, dear listener, for joining us. You make it all worth it. Join us again next week for another edition of Prison Pipeline. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long.
Myself alone, regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving?